welcome along to episode 4 of Adventures in Advising with me, Colm Cronin.
And hey, greetings and salutations for episode 4. This is Matt Markin.
Matt, episode 4, we're four deep at this point.
Yes, we are all in at this point with Adventures in Advising.
It really seems like a blink of an eye since we recorded episode 1. But I think episode 4, we have a really interesting interview talking all about technology, social media, AI. But before we get to that, we probably have a couple of housekeeping things to get through.
Yeah, so on the previous podcast, we talked about deadlines, and there is one coming up. We mentioned it before. I'll mention it again for this one. So February 20th is going to be the deadline, as a reminder, for the Nakata Annual Conference to submit your proposals. So get those in.
Yeah, still a couple of days. And something that we mentioned on the last podcast, it hadn't yet happened, was the Super Bowl. And did you watch it?
I did not watch it. I was doing some other things, so I wasn't able to watch the Super Bowl, but I was keeping in touch with it through social media. So I was following along with what was going on, and I thought the 49ers were going to pull it off, and I was all excited, and I was about to tweet you and say, hey, guess who's going to win, and I am so glad I didn't.
Well, I was excited for you. I thought the 49ers were going to do it, and I did stay up and watch it, and that made the next day exceptionally long. I drank even more coffee than advisors usually do, so you can guess how much I drank.
So by the time the Super Bowl was over, like, what time did you end up going to bed?
It ended here at around about, I think, 20 past 3. So by the time I got into bed, it was close on 10 to 4.
Wow. Trooper.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. And I frequently do that with Broncos games, but usually they so if it's a late game, they start a little bit later. You can kind of get a nap in, but not with the Super Bowl. But hey, you know, it's once a year. We get over it. And the fact that, you know, we were going to be recording an episode this week gave me a bit of an extra bounce in my step. And I think some of the feedback that we have received from people has also given me an extra bounce in my step.
Yeah, same here. So if we go to the Twitterverse, our friends at Inside Track, they sent me a message, a direct message, and I wanted to read it out for listeners because it was just, it's just amazing to get some of this feedback. And so Inside Track put, thanks for putting together and producing Adventures and Advising podcast. We love it, especially the interview with Yvette Barboza. So they're referring to the first episode that we did. That was very heartfelt, and you could hear how much she loves her work and how much Nakata means to her. And we look forward to many more episodes. We wholeheartedly agree and believe that everyone has a story, and it's very inspiring to hear the ones you're sharing. So it's nice that, and thank you, get Inside Track, for that, because that's essentially why we started this podcast and why we're continuing it, because advisors all over the world have stories to share, and you know, it's, we want to get those stories out.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's about sharing stories and giving people, I suppose, a platform so they can share those stories. And I also have some really nice feedback, because when you start a podcast, you're always wondering how it's going to be received, and particularly by people that you like and respect. And one of those people I'm going to give a shout out to is a lady named Rebecca O'Hare. And Rebecca works in Res Life. And Rebecca tweeted, she gave us a shout out. She promoted episode 3. And she said, if you work specifically in the student advising space, there's a lovely new podcast just for you. Created by Colm and Matt, their recent episode reflects on how advising contributes to transforming the student experience. And I just thought it was really nice that somebody who I really like and admire took the time out to give us a shout out. And I got to know Rebecca via I suppose, student support, student services on Twitter. She does some really interesting tweets, particularly around conferences, and she really makes an effort to share her learnings from conferences. And that was originally how I got to know her. And then I was fortunate enough to get some Erasmus funding to go to Manchester last year and to meet up with her. And she showed me around some of the residence halls that she works at. And it was really fantastic experience. And it was through Rebecca, actually, that I got to know our guest for this podcast, one Eric Stoller, who is a man who is, I suppose, most well known for his work in terms of technology, AI, social media. And again, I got to know Eric via social media. He has really wonderful kind of Twitter presence and also on LinkedIn. And I thought that he would make a really interesting person to speak to in relation to technology and advising.
Yeah, and it's great how there's always these connections, and basically meet one person, get to know them, they connect you with someone else, and that's just the life that we live, and it's awesome that these things can happen. And speaking of Eric, that's our next interview. So here we go. All right, we got Eric Stoller. Eric is the VP of Digital Strategy at Echo Engage. Eric has a background in student affairs, academic advising, first-year experience, digital identity, and if that wasn't enough, wellness, orientation, technology, and communications. Eric is a former academic advisor and web coordinator for the College of Health and Human Sciences at Oregon State University. He served previously as a marketing specialist for student affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He received an AA from Indian Hills Community College, a BA in communications, public relations from the University of Northern Iowa, and an EDM in College Student Services Administration from Oregon State University. Eric, how are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Well, I mean, that was one heck of a read there, Matt. Thanks for putting me through the history books there. Gosh, thanks for having me on the show, guys. Glad to be here.
We're delighted to have you on board. It's fantastic to have the opportunity to talk to you. And you have a wealth of knowledge and experience of the higher ed sector, and not only in one country or one continent, but transcontinental. And I think we'll get into that a little bit later. But this being the Adventures in Advising podcast, I suppose one of the things that stands out is you do have experience in academic advising. And I'd be very interested in hearing a little bit more about that, how you got into academic advising and your experiences with it.
Sure. So I've got a, I don't know, like a 25-minute story ready to go here for this. but no, my sort of experience with advising starts off just like a lot of students, where, you know, their first interaction with someone who's a professional or an administrator at an institution is with an academic advisor. And, you know, when I was 18 years old and sort of leaving home for the first time, I was really fortunate in that I had an amazing academic advisor at the community college that I attended. And he was just a wonderful man who, you know, gave me all sorts of insights into, you know, what I needed to, you know, in terms of being successful at this level. And I never, you know, really sort of said, oh, he's my academic advisor. He was just this guy who, you know, I sat down, you know, in his office, and he was across from me on his desk. He had his computer, and he was kind of talking me through different options with classes and courses and things like that. And it's funny, is like, you know, I've been out of, you know, university for a long time. I graduated from that community college and ages ago, and yet I'm still connected with my academic advisor. And funny story is when I went to graduate school and did my EdM, I said to everybody, I will never be an academic advisor. I, even though I had this amazing experience as a student, I always thought I want to be a dean of students or do something with technology. And when I graduated with my higher ed degree from Oregon State, I did a year and a half or so of consulting. And I was miserable. I couldn't take it. I was sort of like, I was used to being around colleagues and other people, and I was on my own, and a friend of mine who was in academic advising. So why don't you try advising? Apply for this job. And I was like, are you serious? That's the one thing I avoided throughout my entire 2 years of grad school. And she said, yeah, give it a shot. And so I thought, you know what, here's an opportunity for me, who's someone who's sort of always been known as the technology aficionado in higher ed, to show that you can still talk to students, you can work with students face-to-face, you know, one after another, in meetings and advising appointments and orientation and whatnot. And so I ended up doing academic advising at Oregon State, as Matt said in the bio read there, for a college that I'm not even sure if it's named that anymore. But I did it for 3 years, and about a year and a half into it, I said, I'm not really jazzed about our sort of college's web marketing stuff. So I renegotiated my job. And for a while before I left that position, I was actually the web coordinator plus academic advisor for that college. So I was basically doing two different jobs and writing for Inside Higher Ed at that time. So yeah, it was a great experience. I still refer to it all the time, you know, peak advising, and, you know, the sort of advising is a tough job. And I think that anybody who's done it knows that, you know, during those sort of peaks when everybody's coming at you with lots of questions and, you know, issues and what have you, you really, really start to appreciate those people who advised you before, you know. And so it's almost like paying it forward.
Definitely. So academic advising, being an advisor, wasn't necessarily something that you sought to do, kind of found yourself in it. Were there any specific student populations that you served as an academic advisor?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was actually pre-med, which is ironic because I am not a doctor. And I was also pre-physical therapy, and sort of pre-OT as well. And so I had all these students that I was working with who needed to take loads of science courses that I never took. And I was having to advise them on, you know, well, here's your physics class and you need to do well. And, you know, here's sort of the sequence required. And so it was always sort of interesting for me having to sort of learn that on top of the advising gig, because there's a lot going on in terms of like all the like the medical school tests and letters of recommendation and internships and hours that students need in terms of shadowing and all the things that they need for applying to medical school. And when I first got the job, I had no idea, you know, and students were coming into my office and asking me questions. And I was just like, let me Google that for you, which became a common phrase. I think if you're advising and you haven't Googled something for students, you're probably doing it wrong.
Oh yeah. It happens every day in my office. If I don't know it, let's Google it and find out.
I think that's one of the beauties though of advising, is that you're always presented with new and interesting situations.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think every single day in advising, you're sort of, you know, you're helping with sort of the academic side of things. You're referring people to counseling and wellness and career services and, you know, doing a bit of life coaching as well. And then you get to do things like presenting at orientation to huge rooms of people, to parents and family members and, you know, transfer students, and also negotiating with the registrar's office and trying to figure out about, you know, can we get another student into this class? Just one more, please.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that, you know, there are a number of things that you said there, but one of the things that I kind of jumped out at me was you referred to yourself as being known as the tech aficionado guy. And I'm wondering, was that always the case? Was that the case when you were growing up or when you were in university? Were you always into tech, or has that been a more recent development?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a bit tech heavy. I mean, my first computer that I sort of played around with was a Commodore 64 that my uncle gave to my mom, and I just kind of played around with it. I mean, when you grow up in rural Southeast Iowa, when there's not a lot going on, literally on a gravel road, you know, it's just sort of like, what can I do? And I always just enjoyed sort of taking apart things that plugged in, which my parents probably didn't exactly enjoy. But then when I went to grad school, literally, if something used electricity, I was sort of always on call for tech support with my classmates, with my professors. And so I've always enjoyed things like graphic design, audio, video editing, and just tinkering around with technology.
So when you were working at Oregon State, so doing both like the academic advising and the web coordinating, was everyone always looking at you as anything that was technology based? They went to you for the answers?
Well, I think part of it was, you know, my interest, because I'm a student success person, right? So at the end of the day, if you're in advising, you want students to have the most successful outcomes possible. And if you start to see sort of issues where maybe communication isn't the best that it could be, or maybe the website could be oriented in a certain way, or just how things are structured, or in terms of how you train and onboard new academic advisors, because there's a lot of knowledge that advisors hold in their heads. How do you get that into various technologies? And so I always sort of found myself in an sort of advocacy role. In fact, when I was an advisor at Oregon State, I remember I did I think it might be the first ever sort of Nakata technology symposium event, where a bunch of us went down to Florida, ironically enough, and we taught things like blogs and wikis and social media. It was very early days. But at the same time, someone had to do it, I guess. And it was really sort of showcases how, Nakata as an organization for advisors has always tried to be on the cutting edge.
Yeah, I suppose, obviously, Nakata is an association that's dear to both myself and Matt. And I'd be interested in, we have obviously found it to be a place that's, open to creativity, has a desire for innovation. And how did you, being an advisor, but there are loads of advisors and not everyone is involved with Nakata. How did you get involved with Nakata?
Yeah, I guess in my career, I sort of have a history of just, not being shy when it comes to asking the leaders of organizations and associations to see where things go. I mean, I remember when I was in my very first student affairs role doing marketing for the University of Illinois at Chicago, it was marketing within student affairs. And at the time, for NASPA was the organization I was really affiliated with, which is sort of a larger umbrella student affairs association. And, with NASPA, their kind of technology-based group, sort of the knowledge community is what they call them, was going to be phased out. It came back later on, but it was going to be phased out at this time. And I remember I called Kevin Kruger at NASPA, who was then sort of second in command. Gwen Dungy was executive director of the association at the time. And I said to Kevin, I said, what's going on? Why are you getting rid of this technology knowledge community? I think it was called the Information Technology Knowledge Community then. And, I kind of go through this whole long spiel. And this is all phone-based, of course, so you can't see me. And then Kevin says to me over the phone, "Who are you again?" Which sort of, began a wonderful friendship. He and I, have just become close friends over the years, having worked together in a variety of capacities. And I think the same thing goes with Nakata. You end up sort of joining forces with like-minded people. And, we're very fortunate. Like Charlie Nutt, he's been around since seemingly forever, when it comes to Nakata, in my eyes anyway. And so, Charlie became someone I was very close to and was very much open to let's try something new. And we were very fortunate. It was an event that was, I think, very well attended. And then when I started kind of breaking into consulting, that's when, I remember I got invited to my first ever paid speaking event when I was a consultant, which is what I used to do before I got this new job with Gecko Engage, was the Oklahoma Academic Advising Association's like annual conference. And they paid me, I think, like $500, and they put me up in a hotel next to a Bass Pro Shop. And I thought I had made it. I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. And I think I had something like 120 slides for 40 minutes of remarks. And it was just ludicrous. I tried to literally talk about everything I could possibly imagine. Learned a lot from that experience. And I think it just goes to show you, like, my whole career has been talking about things like digital transformation and new technologies and how they can enhance the student experience in the here and now. So, back in the day, it was the web, and then it was, social media and blogs. And now I'm getting more into sort of chatbots and artificial intelligence and machine learning.
I'm kind of interested in, you've had the opportunity, I suppose, to work in the UK and to work in the States, and obviously two very different kind of higher ed worlds. And I'm, I suppose, interested in hearing a little bit from you about maybe the differences, the similarities? What was it like for you to transplant yourself from the United States to the UK and to make that transition?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of differences, I think that's a whole nother show in and of itself. I think it's really easy to say, you know, we've got the same language that we're speaking, albeit with different accents. But there's just lots of things in terms of, you know, the meaning of words. You know, even in this podcast column where I've said courses, and I'm thinking in my head, thinking, you know, I just said that to an American audience because. A course, you know, over where you're at over in Ireland is the major, is the degree. And mm-hmm. so I have to really think about things like that. When especially now I work for a company that's based in Scotland. Ironically, I had to leave the UK after 5 years, come back to the States, and then begin working remotely for a UK-based company, which I think is kind of ironic in that. But I think in terms of differences, I mean, in many ways, the professional side of things, the admin side of things, is nowhere near as robust from a budgetary resource personnel perspective over, now I'm not going to say the UK column because you're not in the UK, but it's like, you're very, very close.
We are. They're our next door neighbors.
I've driven between both, you know, and so which is funny because they're like, what? I can't take your UK debit card in Ireland. Which is, I'm like, really? Come on. But I think that, you know, advising, for example, in Ireland or the UK, it's just not the same. You know, you might call it tutoring. You know, there's like UKAT, which is sort of this fairly new advising association that's been kind of helped along by Nakata. But again, you know, just in terms of resource, budget, personnel. And I think part of it is there are a lot of people going to graduate degrees, you know, in higher ed who then go into academic advising. And it's more of a profession in many ways, whereas it's not so much across the pond. And that's not a values thing. It's just the structurally institutions of higher ed, you know, sort of students aren't necessarily at the center as much in Ireland and as in the UK as they are in the US. And I think that part of that has to do with the fact that the US higher ed sector has been sort of marketized and much more sort of consumer oriented for a long time, just in terms of pricing and how things cost and whatnot. And so I think whereas in the US, where you've got a massive issues with retention, and it makes sense to have more advisors to help students complete their courses, and there, see, I messed up there. See, I said it like I was in England, for example. But I mean, you know, students are trying to complete their degrees in the U.S. and there's a lot of transfer, there's a lot of dropouts, there's just or stopouts, there's all kinds of stuff. Whereas in the U.K. and in Ireland as well, and Colin, please correct me if I completely mess up. But people don't really transfer too much. They don't drop out. I mean, you don't have the retention issues in terms of percentage wise, anyway, that they have in the States.
Mm-hmm. No, that I think that's very, everything you've said is very fair in many respects. And, you know, I think that it's really interesting you having worked in both. I mean, I suppose I ran a study abroad program for a number of years, so I have a familiarity with the American model and the American system, but I didn't work in it myself. I do think you're beginning to see sprouts of change in Ireland, particularly in certain institutions, in the way in which students are viewed. I know certainly in DCU, our new president, I saw him speak and I was really heartened because he talked about putting students at the center of everything. And that's not always the case. I think that can be true. It hasn't always been the case, but I think it's beginning to change, which I think is a positive thing because I think there's nobody more invested in an institution than its students. So it's certainly interesting to hear from you as somebody who has worked in both. And I agree we could talk for forever and a day probably about the two systems. And even though we share a common language, I would see there again are differences between Ireland and the UK. But I appreciate and thank you for sharing with listeners your experiences of working in the two.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think it really at the end of the day, if you're a tutor or if you're an advisor, the role is fairly similar. You're really trying to help maximize student success. And usually, you know, there's just one of you and there are plenty of students. And I think that's where, you know, especially my role now, it's about sort of how can you, you know, amplify your ability to serve and support students. And, you know, that's why I started working for a chatbots company, because we realized that, you know, as schools become, you know, sort of more advanced with their recruitment efforts and they're bringing in more and more students. And, you know, especially in the UK where they got rid of the enrollment caps, where it used to be where enrollment was capped. It's kind of a free for all. And then in the States, it's always about growth and recruitment and what have you. I don't think anybody ever thinks from an admissions perspective, oh, gee, what's this going to do to advising and advisors and people who are sort of tasked with retention and doing a lot more student support in the day to day. And I think especially also with like online programs, I mean, who's supporting those students and who's supporting them when, you know, advisors are asleep? And that's where, you know, these new technologies are able to assist and uplift and really support advising teams.
Yeah, and you mentioned the chatbot. So for those that may not know, what exactly is a chatbot and how does that work?
I know, I just get going and I'm like, yeah, let's just start talking about this. So chatbots are basically, they're not so new in terms of technologies. They've been around since like 60s and 70s and sort of early days. Now, the quality is has improved tremendously over the years, but they're artificial intelligence that uses machine learning and a bit of natural language processing. And what that means is people can ask it a question just like they would a person, and it can respond in a very conversational way. You may have seen these sort of on the bottom right of a website if you're on a desktop, or it might just pop up on your mobile device. And a lot of times they'll have sort of a catchy name, usually like an institutional mascot that says right away, hey, I'm not a person, just in case you were curious. And then you can kind of get as much information as sort of has been presented and taught to the bot. Most of these bots kind of learn on an ongoing basis. And I think one of the nice things of them is that, you know, if a student asks a ton of sort of the repetitive, non-complex questions that advisors get asked thousands of times, you know, Matt, you said you Google at least, you know, once a day or what have you in the office. Right. And I think that's where chatbots are perfectly situated to sort of make sure that advisors have high quality conversations with students, while the chatbot handles the quantity of basic, you know, easy to answer questions. And then if it can't get it right, if it doesn't know the answer, and let's say it's 2 a.m. on a Saturday and you guys aren't working because, you know, you like to have a little bit of a rest, and the chatbot can then say, okay, a person will contact you on Monday morning because you gave us your email address, you gave us your phone number, and you gave us your name, and we'll be in touch. And I think the other side of that too is it also provides advisors with information on what the bot doesn't know, so it can be fed into it for the next time. And then it can also tell advisors, these are the key questions that students are having that they just keep asking us. So why aren't we putting more of this information into induction and an orientation or in first year experience and onboarding new students? You know, why isn't this information easily found on our website somewhere else? Or maybe it's the process that's confusing. Because I got to tell you, I mean, when you're working in the U.S. with credits and transferring and a billion different departments, that if you're a student coming in, a lot of this isn't because, you know, you're not up to the task. It's just you don't know what things are called. And you might feel embarrassed. I mean, how many times have you had a student come in, ask a question and sort of ask it meekly because they just thought, well, I don't want to ask this question. And I think those are the perfect kind of questions for things like chatbots, because a chatbot doesn't care, right? It doesn't have a bad day. It doesn't get sick. It gives consistent information, which I think from an advisor's perspective is great, because let's be honest, not all advisors are equal. You two are smiling. I see you on camera. And you know what I'm saying. So I think that's just sort of a little bit of an introduction to chatbots and advising.
Thank you for that. That's a really good explainer, I think, for people. I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate, you know, and say to you, I think some people may have concerns around chatbots replacing advisors.
Right, like Terminators. Yeah. No. Well, I think, you know, it's funny because every single technology that comes out, if you give me a dollar for every time an academic advisor said, well, it's going to take my job. I mean, they were really worried about the fax machine. They were really worried about, you know, the IBM, like really fancy typewriter when it came out. You know, it's sort of like as technologies increase and sort of get better over the years, I think advising as a culture has always said, okay, we are face-to-face, we are one-to-one, and any new technology that comes out is to be feared rather than seeing it as a partner or as something to enhance the work. And I think that's a huge part of it. I think where the chatbot's not replacing anybody, it's just allowing you to have deeper, higher quality answers and conversations to students. Because you think about it, if you're, let's see, it's like peak advising time, you're seeing students like triage in a sense, right? It's like A&E. And for Matt, that's like emergency room. And you're seeing students one after another, boom, 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 boom. And let's say 25% of those students that come in are asking really basic questions that they can do with the bot so easily, right? And they just get on the phone, they're waiting in the hallway for that meeting with you, and they're with the chat bot, they get the information they need, and then you see the next student instead of that one that just found the information on the chat bot, and you're actually able to help them in a really meaningful way because their question was very complex and it required you to do a lot of sort of heavy lifting.
Well, I was going to say that just like as an example would be if departments have like an email address on their website and students are sending, you know, the same questions potentially or questions that could easily be answered, then the chatbot might be able to just go ahead and answer that. And that avoids the advisor, whoever's in charge of answering those emails, to get all those. And maybe they're just answering back the very specific complex questions.
Exactly. I mean, because every advisor has had those moments where they go, I don't know the answer to that. Let me get back to you. And it requires you to sort of like huddle up with some of your colleagues and figure it out. And I think those are the questions where obviously at the moment, a chatbot's not going to get it. But you answer those basic questions, those repetitive ones, sort of general stuff. And it's great because again, the bots can live on any platform too. So, you know, it's not that they have to be on the web or, you know, they can live on social media through Facebook Messenger, on WhatsApp, they can be through text message. You know, you really are reaching students where they are 24/7, 365. And, you know, when I was an advisor, I was working with a lot of international students, you know, prospective students who were thinking about, you know, joining our program. And obviously, I'm going to sleep, you know, and I'm not working all day long. And so something like a chatbot would just, there's so many different ways in which it would enhance not only the student experience, but the experience for advisors. And sort of as part of the advising toolkit, it's going to make things much easier for academic advisors in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely being a little bit of devil's advocate there because I can personally see the benefit that chatbots would bring, because they're especially at the, you know, at peak times during the semester or throughout the year, where, you know, you can be hit by a tsunami of the same question. And students, understandably, sometimes they, you know, they don't always necessarily take it from a website. They wanna have an individual piece. But they are willing to, in my experience, accept the information if it does come from a chatbot. But they want somebody to offer, you know, reassurance rather than just reading it themselves. And I think that can be a way of freeing up a lot of space for an advisor. So it allows you to actually focus on, you know, more serious cases, or to also to plan, because it's at that time of the year where you're constantly swamped and you just don't have the headspace. You can't see the trees or the woods, and you're reacting to things rather than being proactive.
Yeah. When I think about, you know, Matt, I was thinking about how, you know, are you all texting students yet? You know, have students said, I want to be text, you know, SMS me, you know, whatever, the, you know, and I think that's one of those things where, you know, you got to communicate with students where they are. And if it's, you know, in your case, through text messaging, you know, the bot's just going to text you back and forth. Bam, there you go. And if, you know, if it's Column, for example, you Column, if you go into a classroom at your institution and you say, how many of you use WhatsApp? Everybody's going to raise their hand. And if you say, okay, hey, guess what? Here's our new chatbot for advising. And it lives within WhatsApp. It'll help answer your questions. and students get to be on the platform where they're already at, right? You're not sort of creating some other service or tool where students have to figure it out in a place where they've never been before. They're already there.
I think that's huge. I think no matter what phase you're at with students or with anyone, because it's not always just students. I do think sometimes we say things about students. Oh, students are always on their phones. Everyone's always on their phones. And we all prefer to be in a place where we're comfortable. So if you're going to make people go and sign up to some new platform that they're not familiar with, it's much more difficult to get people to do that. Where if you can, I think that's the key phrase there, Eric. Meet people where they're at. It makes such a difference to the student experience, to the user experience, to everyone's experience. And I really think that the experience is key right now, because there's lots of knowledge available out there. But it is to make it, to personalize it and to make people feel like they are listened to. And I think, you know, to provide, there's no way advisors are going to be able to answer every single question for every single student. So what's the best way that we can resource this, that we can make sure that, you know, the different needs of students are met, if it's in the US where you're talking about retention, or if it's in the UK and Ireland where it might be a little bit different. But how can we best go about this? And I do think that's where technology can really assist us.
Well, I think, you know, it's just like anything. It just keeps evolving. You know, when I was initially doing academic advising, it was all paper-based. You know, it was all, we had files, we'd open them up and there'd be notes inside, and I write unbelievably bad. And you know, trying to read my own notes was difficult enough, let alone someone else trying to read those notes. And I think that's where, you know, the sort of culture of academic advising as a profession needs to just embrace technology as a partner, as part of sort of the process of, this is how we amplify the jobs that we're here to do, rather than think about how could this take something away or have a culture of fear, which I think it makes total sense, right? That's sort of been the attitudes in a lot of different spaces within HE. And again, it's about, this helps you and it makes things easier. And yeah, it's up to you to sort of figure out how you use it and implement it in a way where you feel comfortable with it.
You don't think your writing's bad. You haven't seen mine, so I don't think you want to.
It's funny, exactly, because I write like a doctor, you know, or a wannabe doctor. But it's, you know, it's funny because I remember part of this was, I was always just never had enough time. And I wanted to write sort of rich notes about sort of what students were bringing up and the questions they had and sort of their progression. And I was trying to write as fast as I possibly could. I got so sort of into it where I was saying to sort of the director of the office, I was saying, these are the only pens that I can write with because they're faster than the other pens. And that's sort of like, there's new technologies now where advisors actually can sort of access things and students can access things on the web or on mobile. And I think that's, again, where it's a combination of people plus technology equals student success.
Yeah. And speaking of like students, there's always social media and things that are ever changing. And then tied to that, it's, you know, digital identity. Could you tell us more exactly about how you define digital identity and why that's important to students especially?
Yeah, and it's a bit of a different angle, I think, digital identity. You know, in my own head, it's evolved over the years. It used to be sort of, you know, your brand was the language that I was using a while ago. And now it's sort of just about who you are, just as a whole sort of encapsulation of your person, right? Because I don't believe in this sort of separation of there's you in person, brick and mortar, flesh and blood, and then there's you online in a digital environment and you're two separate things. I think you're really just, there's just one you. And I think your digital identity has to be representative of the fact that if I meet you in real life and you're amazing and I look at your stuff on social media and it's not so much the same in alignment, you know, that's a very powerful disconnect. And so whenever I work with students, I think about the sort of what self are you putting out there for your class, your peers, your you know, professors, the people who are mentoring you, the people you're mentoring, like say you're a peer mentor, and then once you graduate from an employability perspective as well. I think that that's where with advisors especially, there's this, while we're not in a career services department, we do a lot of careers advising. And it's just natural, I think, in terms of what advisors have to do. When you say advising is teaching, that's sort of the mantra in the US. Part of that is what happens beyond the classroom and beyond the institution. And I think when it comes to social media and someone's digital identity, it's about figuring out, okay, what is it you're trying to accomplish later on in terms of, hey, I need to be on LinkedIn now and building my profile out and learning how this platform really works. Or, you know, I'm not going to post a ton of stuff on Twitter, but I'm going to use it intelligently to network and connect with people who I should know and I'm interested in. And so, you know, look at Instagram, and you know, there's this sort of pervasiveness of people having multiple accounts, you know, like Finstas and all that. And I think it's fascinating to see how it's evolved. And you know, and then Snapchat used to be the sort of social media app that we'd all kind of lambast, and that's shifted a bit. And Instagram has sort of taken all of that functionality in many ways. And now we've got TikTok. And you know, one of my favorite TikToks is actually a University of Limerick column. You know, shout out to Ireland. And you know, I think that's where you know, will we laugh at these platforms now? Some of them anyway, like TikTok, right? It's kind of silly, it's kind of fun. But personally, I don't find anything wrong with silliness or fun. But the perception, I think, is that these platforms have no value. And I think, especially from a digital identity perspective, and I think at the end of the day, we said the same things about Facebook. We said the same things about Twitter. We said the same things about this or that. And it just seems like the natural evolution is, you know what? There are already people who are in their teens who are literally making a career out of being on something like TikTok, and bash them all you want, but they're doing it. So it still very much matters.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And delighted that you recognize what Limerick are doing, because certainly I too, and big shout out, I think Tony Sheridan is the guy who runs their social media, and they've done a phenomenal job. And I think to me, what stands out for what Limerick are doing, and in terms of, I think, digital identity, brand, everything you've been speaking about is totally accurate. But one of the things I think it ties into right now is around authenticity.
Absolutely. I mean, people have to be themselves, right? And students will see that immediately. You know, I think when it comes to academic advising departments, sometimes there's choice, right? Students can choose who they want to talk to. And I think, you know, they can figure out right away who they want to see over and over again. By the way, before I forget, I also want to make mention of the fact that, you know, in addition to this digital identity piece, and really related to it, is this sense of digital literacy or digital fluency. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I did a lot of when I was doing my speaking and consulting work before I started with Gecko in the UK in particular, was how digital literacy and digital fluency was just sort of floating around. You know, there was not a lot of ownership at a departmental level, at a level that was structured at an institution. And I think over time, it'll be interesting to see if that changes, because I mean, how many times have you guys as academic advisors talked with students and had to really sort of walk them through sort of things that related to digital literacy first before they could actually get to whatever they were trying to accomplish? You know, it happens over and over again, right? I mean, how many times you talk to, you know, Matt, and, you know, you see a senior, you know, and they're, let's say they're a 50-year senior, they're fairly close to graduation, maybe, hopefully. And they go, yeah, I don't even know how to do this. And it's something within the student information system. And you go, how have you made it this far without knowing these basic sort of utility and functionality pieces?
Yeah. And I think it happens quite a bit. And then you realize that somehow they got through it, or someone helped them with it, and they just made it through, and now they're going to be graduating.
Exactly. And you always think about those missed opportunities, or at least that's, I think for me, that's what I think about. I mean, I think obviously you guys know that I'm sort of like the chatbot evangelist full time. And I always think about how a chatbot can sort of ease those sort of pain points and ease those missed opportunities. And so, you know, think about orientation, how many pieces of paper do students get? How many lectures do they sit in, presentations do they have to sit in? And they just start to forget things. And there's all this onboarding that happens, and like IT help desk is just bombarded by things all the time. And I think about how artificial intelligence can sort of help, you know, span these gaps, or help, you know, plug these holes where students are falling through the cracks because it never stuck, or they, you know, life happens and they were too busy, or, you know, they were working afterwards and they forgot everything. And so then you think, okay, hey, they're on their mobile, they're on their phone, they asked this question, there's the answer. It's so much easier.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things that jumped out to me there, Eric, was, and Matt and I have discussed this, and one of the things I think that's where we miss out on is around what we would call, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on the first years, on the freshman students. But when they move into what we would call second year, they've gotten a huge amount of information, particularly in the early part of first year. They go through the academic year, then they go away for a summer, then they come back and they're expected to, you know everything as if they never left. And I think that's where technology could be really useful, in having a kind of a reorientation or a refresher program, as we'd probably call it. Yep. Over here. I think that could be, because again, you advisors don't have the capacity to take on that sort of a second year orientation. But I do think that, you know, a lot of students can need that. Like you get one library tour maybe at the beginning of your first year, and certainly, you know, how many first years really use the full capacity of a library? And that's it very often. And unless you're a brave enough student to, you know, go up to the desk and to ask, but not every student is going to do that. So technology, AI, chatbots, virtual tours, they could all make a real difference to the student experience.
Well, I think regardless of what you think about maybe the sort of scholarly research around nudging and, you know, nudge technology or sort of that philosophy, I think about how advisors can proactively use tech to nudge students. You know, Colm, you're saying about the year two students, being able to nudge students periodically via SMS or through a WhatsApp message that lives in a sort of AI-driven chatbot means that you can then, you know, just kind of ping them ever so gently, essentially, and say, here's some more information coming up, and things change too. Because how many times have you heard a student come into your office and say, one, I never got the email, or I didn't read it. And you know, a lot of times it's not the student's fault, because sometimes we get carried away and we write a 17 bullet point, you know, equivalent to War and Peace email, and then kick it off to students and go, well, why didn't you read, you know, bullet point 7, part B? I mean, why didn't you see? And so I think there's expectations there where, you know, if you can use tech mm-hmm. to proactively nudge students in a way in which they're very familiar. I mean, I think there's some really mm-hmm. great stats, and I unfortunately don't have them off the top of my head, but around how people will pay much closer attention to a text message than almost anything else.
I think it's also, if you think of just even a college bulletin, it has all the policies, procedures in there, and yet we expect students to know everything that's in there because it's written somewhere in writing or online, but they may not know about it, or they're not going to take the time to go through it. But if you think of like orientation, you know, kind of what we're saying too, it's a lot of orientations might be 1 or 2 days and they get a lot of information dumped on them. And then we expect them to still remember everything when they start school a month or two later.
Yeah. And I think the orientation process too, especially if you're going through a registration process during orientation, it can be very stressful for students. I mean, I always felt sort of the anxiety that students carried into that process with them, especially as the, you know, in a U.S. context, so sorry, Colm, but in a sort of like summer orientation program where students were registering, you know, if they came to a later in the summer program and there were fewer classes available, and it makes it harder in terms of trying to figure out the schematics of what their schedule might look like, you know, that's a lot of anxiety. That means you're not going to remember anything else that you're told. It's just going to go, it's just going to vanish. And then I think during the course of the year, you know, advisors kind of have to carry that burden, you know, and shoulder that responsibility of what happens during orientation, you know, then comes back how many, like tenfold onto advisors.
Yeah. I think I'm thinking of my own self, and when, you know, you're how much I rely, having, you know, I've moved institutions a few times, on SOPs and referring back and being able to check things. And for students, they don't always have, you know, clear access to that sort of material. They're given it once, and then the only place they know to go sometimes is to their advisor. So yeah, I think there's a huge amount of truth in what you're saying, Eric, and how technology could be used to ease the burden, not just on students, but on advisors as well.
Exactly. So like the sort of like fear of, oh, is it going to take my job, or is it going to, you know, take people out of the equation? It's the complete opposite. You know, I think you're going to see more and more people who are in sort of, I saw a great quote the other day, and it was sort of like that there's so many jobs today, they're going to go away, but it's those jobs of the future that come in to replace those roles. So it's not like, you know, the jobs go away and there's nothing. It's that there's actually new roles, new jobs, new responsibilities. It's just like my role when I had a joint web sort of marketing and comms job whilst also being an academic advisor. That's a very different kind of position. But you think about hybridized roles and sort of future roles, there's going to be a lot more technology in there. I mean, you think about the academic advisor who never sees a student face-to-face and is online only, and their job is to serve students who are distributed around the globe, and how technology can help that academic advisor serve students all the time. I mean, there's only one advisor, but there's all sorts of technologies that help that advisor answer thousands of questions.
Yeah, most definitely. And this has been a very interesting, engaging topic to talk about, various things that we did. And thank you so much, Eric. And we'd love to have you on for a future podcast if you're interested.
Of course. Always ready. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. I think there's so much that we have still to discuss, and it has been an absolute pleasure to chat to you. I would encourage listeners to, if you're not already following Eric on the various social media platforms, definitely check him out. He's a guy who posts really interesting things. And I think one of the things, just briefly, is you're prepared to break a little bit with convention, which I think I have learned a lot from. I remember when, you retweeted your own tweet, and somebody kind of said, whoa, what's going on here? You can't do that. And you explained the rationale behind it. And yeah, I think that we could all learn a little bit more from that.
I think my quote on that was, and I said this at the University of Michigan a few weeks ago, I said, if you're not self retweeting, do you even Twitter?
Well, I think there's amongst all of the wonderful nuggets that we've had in the last 50 or so minutes, there's a real practical piece that everyone can take from this.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
I think to have the opportunity to have a chat to Eric, and I found that fascinating. I thought he offered amazing insights. I think that we probably could have spoken for another hour. I think we definitely should have him back for a future episode. Thanks to him again for taking the time. I really think any listeners are going to take a lot away from that. And I think, Matt, it's not just going to end with Eric on this episode. I believe there might be one or two bonus interviews.
Yeah, and thanks again for Eric for joining us for that podcast and for that interview. And definitely look forward to having him on again. And yes, just like you said, we do actually have some bonus interviews for you all. And while I'm here at CUCUSB, I was able to chat with a couple people that I thought would be great for this podcast to share their story. So the first one up is from Deborah Parsons. She works for the College of Social Behavioral Sciences. She's an assistant dean in the College of Social Behavioral Sciences. She's someone that I've actually known for many years, and I was actually a student of hers for her Criminal Justice 101 intro class back in 2006. And the one thing she taught me in her class that I'll always remember for criminal justice was that for every rule or every law, there's always an exception. And that is something that I've taken with me through my time working in the admissions office and the last now 7 years working, or almost 7 years working as an academic advisor when working with students. So in this interview, Deborah Parsons talks about how the advising landscape has changed at CUCSB through the years, her time in law enforcement, and how that has helped her in teaching, as well as her path in education, and also the time that she met Prince. So here we go. I think this will be a fun interview. I got some questions to ask you. So one is, you've worked at Cal State San Bernardino for a few years now.
Right.
How has the advising landscape changed from when you started to now?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I can tell you that it has changed remarkably. First of all, one of the things that I came from a university where we did have an advising staff. So when I first came here, I had all these students lined outside my office, and I asked them, "What are you doing here?" And they said, "Oh, we're here for advising." And I said, "Well, go to your advisor." And they go, "No, you are our advisor." And I went, "Oh, no, I can't be." So I realized that the faculty do the advising here, and I wasn't really prepared for that. I was more interested in, of course, being a first-time professor and teaching and research. I had no idea about the advising. So I started getting into the advising, and I really enjoyed it. And so I would volunteer for, we had orientations that were like one day. And it was for freshmen only. It wasn't for transfer. And so I would volunteer my Saturday to come in and meet with students. And I'd have my bulletin of the Cal State bulletin, and I'd have my schedule of classes, and I'd sit down with students who came in for advising, and I really messed them up.
I doubt that.
Well, you'd be surprised. I knew nothing about, even though I had been through so many years of the bachelor's program, master's program, and doctorate program, I didn't really know about general education or the policies and things like that. Over the course of the years, of course, I've learned more about how to advise students properly. But in the beginning, it was just sort of hit and miss. And I didn't even know really the curriculum of my department. I just knew what I taught. So, you can see how unprepared we were for, I think, faculty. Some of them probably did it well, some of them didn't. But back in 2014, decided to hire 5 academic advisors, professional advisors for the colleges. And what we discovered was that every college could benefit from having somebody who was professionally trained as an advisor, and it was so helpful. And I didn't realize it was a thing, and when I saw how great they advised, I was amazed at the information and the theory behind it and everything. So during that time, there was a lot of controversy, a lot of pushback on advising and having professional advisors. And so that was part of the issue, is whether faculty could give up that role. But I saw these young people did it much better than we did, because they actually learned how to do it and went to school for it. So from that time, we've really developed. I now have a team of advisors working for me, and we really want to touch every single student and be able to help every single student and not have them fall through the cracks.
Absolutely. And it's definitely changed a lot. And, you know, now even with staff advisors, professional advisors, we have advisor training for them and we have advising institutes for them, and totally different than what it was just a few years ago.
Right. And I wish that had been available for me as a faculty advisor. That would have been so helpful.
And but it's always that learning curve too. And ultimately you figured out a way to learn the information, trial and error.
Yeah.
Now as an administrator, a lot of times I hear administrators say how they miss the teaching or they miss the students. They lose out on that student interaction. But as assistant dean, you've actually found a way to still have some type of student connection. How did you work that out?
My role is assistant dean of student success for the college. So my actual role is handling all student issues in the college. And I meet with students on a regular basis. I think the difference, of course, is the fact that in teaching, you develop relationships during the quarter or the term, because we're moving to semesters, but we develop relationships, and those can be lasting relationships. The role I'm in now is more problem solving, facilitating some kind of solution for a student. I don't really see students on a regular basis. Some students do call me and say thank you very much. I've received cards and things like that, but mostly the difference is that I'm handling student issues full time. And I've learned to really appreciate all the different students and their you know, helping with their path and showing them that, hey, it's not always a perfect path. You know, you sometimes have to take time off, or you sometimes pick the wrong major, or you have trouble in a class or whatever. So that's the part I love. So I've moved away from the teaching role, but in a way I'm still teaching, and it's not about the content of my PhD, which was criminal justice or criminology. But it's more about, you know, the human aspect of it and really connecting with students on that level.
Absolutely. And teaching happens in many different ways. And you've actually been a faculty member for about 25 years now. And also, you are in law enforcement.
Yes.
So how has law enforcement maybe helped you in your teaching?
Well, I could say that when I was teaching in the classroom, which was about 5 years ago now, the students really liked the fact that I had experience in the field, and so I had credibility with the students. They understood that I've been there, done that, and I had lots of stories for them, you know.
And I know some of those.
My stories were always about, you know, the job, and it was exciting for these students that want to get into law enforcement, get into law, get into working in the prison system or the corrections or whatever. I think I was able to give them that real world experience. And I think that is one of the things that I was able to bring into teaching. But also, I think it helped me with being a little bit more disciplined. I was fun in the classroom, but I also had a sense of discipline. And I think students also appreciated that part of it too. And now in my role now, I think the police experience has very helped me immensely. For one reason, I'm constantly mediating and negotiating with faculty and students, and I work problems out, and it's the same thing I kind of did in the field, helping people solve their problems. And I can't solve it for them, but helping them think of ways. I always start off with a student is, how would you like to handle this? How would you resolve this? So that it makes them think and critically think about how they want to do things. And sometimes they say, I want the professor fired. Well, that's not going to happen. So let's come up with a solution together. What can we do? And so we work things out. And I did that in the field. as a police officer. And I think that's what made me successful there as well.
So last question would be, what is your biggest takeaway from your career?
So, I think that, you know, I came into academia to teach, and I love criminology and the subject matter. But what I learned along the way is that really isn't about the subject, it's about the human contact that I have. And I think that's what made me successful in the classroom, was because I really cared more about the students than I cared about the content of what I was teaching. I think they enjoyed what I was teaching because I was engaged with them and they were engaged with me. And I think my takeaway is that the role I'm in, I've always been in this role. Really, it's really guiding students, mentoring students to find their pathway. I started late. I went to 5 different community colleges. I finally ended in law enforcement, and then I decided I wanted to go back to school and get my degrees, and so I did that. And so my pathway was sort of late and long. I didn't receive my PhD till I was 40. And I think from there, I've had a very great career in just doing exactly what I love to do, which is to interact and engage with students and help them find their pathway.
So I thought that was going to be the last question, but last question.
Last question.
You used to work for Prince, or had something to do with Prince.
Oh, well, no, wait a minute. I worked at the Fabulous Forum when it was the Fabulous Forum, and then it was the Great Western Forum. And so I worked with a lot of groups. You know, I worked with them backstage, and I got to meet a lot of famous people. I mean, Kiss, Rod Stewart, you name it, I met them. And I did a lot of backstage, you know, a lot of the things that I worked on was really before the concert. So I did go to a lot of the after concert things. And yes, Prince did ask me out. I was in my 20s. And that is also where I became interested in police work. I was always more interested in what the police were doing, the crowd control and things like that. And I was like, oh, that looks interesting. I don't know why I thought that was more interesting than being famous, but
everyone's different.
Yeah, everybody's different. But so one time I was eating my lunch in my car and a police officer came by and he started talking to me, and you know, we were just chatting, and all of a sudden he got a call for a 927D, and I went, "What's that?" And he goes, "A dead body." Oh, I just had to be a police officer then. It was so much more interesting than eating my lunch in the parking lot at the forum.
So that sealed the deal.
Yeah, that sealed the deal. So, yeah, I decided that I had to get into law enforcement because I wanted to be the one at the scene. And ever since then, I've made a scene.
I knew we were going to have at least one of these moments. This is usually how it is in meetings, which is why I love Dr. Parsons.
That is true. But, you know, that's why the students love me, too. In fact, I was reading on Rate My Professor. A student said, I missed my calling. I should have been a comedian. And I thought, no, I didn't miss my calling. I've got an audience.
Wow, what a fantastic Prince anecdote Deborah had. What does the next interview hold in store, Matt? Yeah,
definitely. And she's someone I think you would get along with right away. She's super funny, and I would love for you to meet her. The next one we have is a good buddy of mine. His name's Michael Harrison. He's actually someone that started out as my student assistant in admissions way back when in 2004. And now today we actually work in the same office as academic advisors. So it's been great to see Michael start out from a student to staff, you know, to now working as an academic advisor here in the same office. So in this interview, he talks about what college and specifically CSUSB means to him, what he's learned from attending academic advising conferences such as NACADA, and incorporating his hobbies into academic advising. So take a listen. Michael, how you doing?
I'm doing wonderful, thanks.
And since we are at Cal State San Bernardino, where we work for a very long time, you've been a student, you've been an admissions recruiter, admissions counselor, you've been right now an academic advisor. So you've done a lot of different perspectives. What does Cal State San Bernardino mean to you?
Well, it's meant so many different things. So it's been a place of learning for me, whether it's learning in the classroom, going in the library, reading books in the library. It's been a social place, you know, getting a chance to go to events, whether it's open mic nights or different kinds of any of the fun events that they have on campus, game nights, things of that nature. And then it's been a place of business and a place of work. So from being a student, being a tour guide, introducing people to the campus, and then being a recruiter where now you're out in the community going to talk to people about the opportunities here. So I've had the opportunity to experience it as a student, but then also promote it and sell it. And then as an academic advisor to guide people through it as they're getting toward graduation. So I've had a lot of different relationships with it, but it's been so much to me because I've been here since 2004. So it's definitely been a lot for me.
Yeah, and I feel like for both of us, we've grown up here at this university. And I've definitely got to see you grow, because little known fact is Michael used to be my student assistant back in the day when we worked in admissions. And now we get to work as colleagues together here in advising academic services at Cal State San Bernardino, working as academic advisors. And something we've also gotten to do together is attend many conferences and gotten to present together a lot. And let me ask you that about conferences. So, I mean, you've attended conferences, you've presented. Is there anything that you've learned from attending conferences that maybe others could gain knowledge from you on?
Yeah, I think when you attend a conference, especially if you're presenting, you are, for me, nervous about the information that you're going to present. You know that you know the information, but then how will it be received? And sometimes you know the information, but you're not sure that you know. And so it gives you confidence to be able to speak on behalf of your experiences, what you've done, what's worked for your campus, and how that can benefit others. And then also just from sitting in workshops with other advisors around the world and around the country, hearing their experiences. And a lot of times you're just, you know, in between workshops, you're actually gaining useful information, best practices, things that you can think about. But then when you are outside of the workshops, now you have a chance to actually sit there and dialogue with people. And you realize that we share a lot of the same experiences across the globe. And so we've been able to take a few things from conferences and bring them back to our own campus. And then others have reached out to, you know, us to find out about some of the information that we presented on that they felt like they could use. So I think it's a good way to develop relationships across the campuses. When you see somebody again that you saw at a previous conference, you can strike up conversation. So it's definitely a wonderful experience to be able to attend, and it can be nerve-wracking to present, but once you're in the mode of presenting, you start talking to people, it's a wonderful experience too.
Yeah, definitely. The networking piece is amazing. I've getting to attend conferences multiple times, see the same people. Speaking of being nervous, I mean, you've seen me at my worst being nervous of getting ready for a presentation, but also once you're done with it, it's like, oh, it's over.
Yes.
All that preparation time is definitely worth it. So kind of coming back to Cal State San Bernardino and what you do here as an advisor, outside of this, you do a lot, have a lot of different projects that you work on. I mean, you draw, you're a photographer. Have you been able to incorporate that into your academic advising or what you do here as an advisor?
Oh, absolutely. Just from on a very, very practical level, when it comes to photography, I've had the opportunity to photograph a few events on campus, so smaller events that we've had that I've been invited to, whether it's our annual Coyote Advising Academic Fair that we have, or a few of the smaller graduation ceremonies. So there's been that opportunity networking with people, knowing what I do. I write as you know, I like to draw. And I think a lot of that helps when relating to students. So when students come in and students are in that place where they're trying to figure out what it is that they want to do, knowing that I can have a career and then also still do the things that I'm interested in, whether they're interested in the arts or whatever it may be that they're interested in. And then people connect with you. Like for yourself, you have, you know, your office. When people come in, they can connect with you that way. I think having outside things that you do also allows you to connect with students and let them know that they can do it too.
Very nice. And behind us, we have quite a few pins on this board. And actually, there's one up there that Michael did the artwork for that we were able to create a pin for students for our finals week encouragement event. It said the Eat, Sleep, Study, Repeat. And it was a drawing of like a cartoonish drawing of one of our staff members here, Lachey. So shout out to Lachey and all the work that you do here at this university and in our office. But it's nice that something that you do, some that are for fun as a hobby, we're able to incorporate that, and also things that you do more than a hobby, you're able to incorporate as well into your work here. And I think it's been great, and it's been awesome working with you all these years. Probably wrap it up because I know it's peak registration time. We got some more appointments that we got to get done, but wanted to squeeze some time in today so we can knock this one out. And Michael, appreciate it.
That guy has like proper presence.
Oh, absolutely. He's a natural. I'm always in awe every time he does anything in any of the advising videos that he joins in on.
Yeah, I mean, he stood out to me. He stood out to other people who've watched the videos. People have commented. That guy. So, I mean, let's continue to have him appear in our videos. And thanks to him for a really interesting, insightful interview.
Oh, absolutely. He is more than willing to be in any of the videos that we do. And he's just an awesome person. And he's one of the best things that's happened to me in terms of his growth here at the university and just getting to watch him watch him do what he does. And he teaches me a lot as well.
I think I need to get myself to California for a visit.
Yeah, come on by. You got a place to stay and I'll give you a tour and all of that and have you have a lot of fun here in Southern California and meet a lot of the folks that you've seen in some of these videos.
Sounds good. Hopefully listeners have enjoyed today's episode and the interviews. I think it has been fascinating and insightful. I want to give a big thank you to Eric Stoller for taking the time to chat with us. Really appreciate that.
Yeah, and of course, special thanks as well to Deborah Parsons and Michael Harrison.
And remember, for anyone out there, we are always looking for ideas. We love your feedback. You can find myself and Matt on Twitter, on LinkedIn. You can find this podcast at Advising Podcast on Twitter. We would love for you to leave a review, subscribe on whatever platform you listen to podcasts. We will be back again on the first Monday in March, which is the 2nd of March. And in the interim, I am going to take a trip to India. What have you got coming up, Matt?
Oh, I'm not flying anywhere, so I will be here. So probably while you're in India, I'll be meeting with a lot of students.
Okay, so it'll be hot and sunny in both locations.
Oh, yeah, it's always perfect weather here in California.
So I hear. Well, listen, look forward to episode 5.
All right, we'll see you then. Don't want a complication.